The information and opinions you hear on this radio show are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KFNX, its affiliates, management, or advertisers.
Successful Aging, giving you winning strategies for living well and loving life. Your hosts are John Wenslow, Chief Executive Officer, and Millie Okeson, Vice President of Marketing for Friendship Retirement Corporation. There's a difference in just living and living well. The aim of this show is life and how you live it. Welcome to Successful Aging. Now, here are your hosts.
Good morning and welcome to Successful Aging, where we provide you with the latest trends, health updates, and expert advice for living well and loving life. I'm your host, John Wenslow, here with my co-host, Millie Okeson. Good morning, Millie.
Good morning.
Got another great show today. Tell us about it.
We do. I'll tell you, the day that we say we don't have a good show, I'm going to be shocked because they're all so good. So before we start, I just want to say hi to everybody. We are streaming live on Facebook right now, and you can catch us over on our Facebook page, Successful Aging, sponsored by Friendship Retirement Corporation. Today we have Stacy Lynch with us. Stacy has been on our show before, and Stacy currently works full time as an aquatic therapist at Okeson Physical Therapy in Peoria. He continues and is passionate about his work on the development of aquatic programs for residents with dementia in the long-term care communities. He is also the founder and owner of Inertia Therapy Services, where he hopes to help and make a difference in the healthcare industry in America. He is the U.S. organizer for the Association of International Aquatic Therapy Faculty. Stacy was integral to the first published case review of aquatic therapy and Alzheimer's disease, and co-wrote the first published case review on aquatic therapy and end-stage dementia. He is an international keynote speaker. We've actually had him speak at several of our conferences and things like that, and has been a guest on a number of podcasts and webinars, including the aquatic section of the American Physical Therapy Association. Welcome, Stacy. We're thrilled to have you back again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Stacy, I echo that. It's great to have you back. You know, we do a lot of therapy on our show, physical occupational, et cetera, but aquatic therapy has some amazing results. And we don't talk about it nearly enough. You've had some personal experience with helping your mom through total knee replacements. How have you used that aquatic therapy to help her through that healing process?
Well, I'll tell you in a couple of weeks. My mom actually lives in Texas, and I generally see her like once or twice a year. And she's always had problems with her knees since I can remember, as a child due to a car accident. And when she was visiting me in Las Vegas last year, when I was hosting an international research conference, I started limping and wincing more than I ever had in my past. Mm-hmm. And so we entered into a dialogue about a total knee surgery. And there was a little resistance on her part, but I've been told that I can be like a dog with a bone. So I convinced her to schedule for a total knee surgery.
You gave her a bone.
And I'm sure that you all know someone that's had a total knee surgery. We were talking about this in the back.
Yeah, she's right here in the studio.
They are very effective knee joint replacements, but the rehab can be very, very painful. And mostly this is because rehabs following surgery can be aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, as a therapist, when I'm rehabbing a total hip or pretty much any other joint following surgery, I generally do everything I can to minimize the pain. But when it comes to a total knee, I would say that pain really just gets in the way of what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
I try to minimize the pain, but the truth is pain is expected. And so I'm a whole different person when I'm dealing with my total knee patients. And it's my personal experience that patients respond much better with less pain when aquatic therapy is part of the rehab. So I actually flew my mom out to Arizona so that I could have a doctor here that I was familiar with and that I could personally work with her in the water. And she's having her post-op visit this Thursday, and we'll be getting her evaluated for therapy on Friday, and hopefully we'll be getting her in the water in the next visit or two. And really, it depends on the surgeon's closure technique as far as when getting in the water can happen, sometimes sooner, sometimes later. So far, my mom looks good, and I can't wait to get her in the water.
And your mom used the same surgeon that Kay used.
Yes, Dr. Rosen Phoenix Orthopedic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did Kay have aquatic therapy after the fact?
No, but she wished she did.
She wished she had now.
Yes.
All right. What makes us so different?
Just aquatic therapy. Well, I love talking about this. And the last time you had me on the show.
I hadn't noticed, okay?
remember Ron was on with him last time.
Yeah, last time you had me on the show, I gave a quick rundown on the history of aquatic therapy. And I mentioned that this is nothing new to the medical field. So I don't want to rehash that. But in looking at the benefits of aquatic therapy, it needs to be stated that as early as 400 BC, Hippocrates had used what was called the water cure. And this focused on the taking in of the waters, and this varied with cold and hot water temperatures, everything from enemas to drinking large volumes of water, as well as bathing in various temperatures of the water for different physical and mental responses. And a later emphasis was placed on the act of bathing in different mineral springs, ranging from salt to magnesium and sulfur to even arsenic baths. And this gave varying results, and this was pretty much widely known as balneotherapy. Mm-hmm. Now, understanding that Hippocrates is known as the founder of Western medicine, when you look at modern Western medicine, I believe that the totality of balneotherapy sounded a little too hippie-like. So in the 1990s, we started using the term medical hydrology, and I think it sounds much more scientific. So when we look at the basis of medical hydrology, I want to point out that these benefits I'm going to state are simply with getting in the water chest to neck level deep without even doing anything. These benefits are not speculations. They're not theories. They've been well studied and documented. A lot of research began in the 60s and the 70s during NASA's space program. And recently there's been another surge with the research, and we found benefits to most every system in the body. Everybody talks about buoyancy. Mm-hmm. If you remember the Brady Bunch, when Jan would say, Marsha, 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 this is what I tend to hear is buoyancy, buoyancy, buoyancy. And it is true that everyone touts the buoyancy effects, and it can remove up to 75% of your body weight. And this is very important for a lot of our pain patients and our weak patients if they're dealing with weakness or balance deficits. And, of course, patients dealing with pain. But I think that buoyancy barely cracks the surface when it comes to the benefits of aquatic therapy. Most of what we find is with hydrostatic pressure. Mm-hmm. And this hydrostatic pressure pushes in on the body, and it's like squeezing on a water bottle. It causes blood to move upward. So when you're neck level in the water, this pressure causes a 60% increase in thoracic volume. And this leads to an increase in cardiac stroke volume of up to 35%. And you have to understand that's at rest. This means that you're getting a 35% cardiovascular exercise, even if you're not doing anything when mm-hmm. you're chest level in the water. And it's more than that. It's actually the equivalent to someone initiating a land-based cardiovascular activity, and that's while doing nothing. So patients with hypertension actually tend to have lowered blood pressure. Immersion has also been found to significantly reduce pain perception during and after. Muscle blood volume increases by 225%. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I believe patients just want to start moving when they get in the water, it's not so much because of the buoyancy, but the muscles are basically full of fuel and they're looking for something to do. In fact, in 2002, EMG studies revealed that the neuromuscular system is basically turbocharged in the water. This is not due to buoyancy. Imagine the water pouring out of a garden hose. It goes out and down. Now imagine if you put your thumb over half of that hose, the pressure and efficiency of the stream is enhanced. And this is what I believe the pressure is doing to the neuromuscular system. As a neurological therapist, this allows me to basically upgrade the patient's neuromuscular system from a V6 to a V8. So I'm always excited when I get a neuro patient. Finally, we have plasma dopamine levels tend to increase with immersion, and dopamine correlates with mood state. Anxiety levels tend to decrease by about 40%. And research has revealed recently that immersion at chest to neck level in the water actually increases blood flow to the brain by 7 to 10% at rest. And this usually lasts for a couple of hours.
I know we're going to get on to a hard to break here in a minute, but a question that I have is on the water piece and minimizing of pain is, I can understand that, you know, it's the pressure on the joints, for example, if you don't have surgery, mm-hmm. that relieves the pressure. But at some point in the way, is there a certain depth that it has to be? I know that as you go deeper in water, for example, there's more pressure on your body. Is there a certain minimum, maximum that you need to have for water therapy?
It's really up to the patient. I mean, basically, most of the research is chest and neck level. But anything is better than nothing, from what I found.
Okay. All right.
Well, you're listening to Successful Aging on Independent Talk 1100 KFNX. And when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Stacy Lynch, aquatic physical therapist, on the research of aquatic therapy and Alzheimer's disease. Come on back. You don't want to miss this. Welcome Welcome back. We are talking with Stacy Lynch. Stacy's an aquatic therapist for OCAS and physical therapy in Peoria. And before the break, you were talking a little bit about some of the benefits and things like that. And our question during the break that we were thinking of is, why don't doctors refer to aquatic therapy right out of, you know, right after they've had, a patient has had surgery?
That's what I've been asking for about 15 years. It's pretty much always the same answer is mostly an awareness and an education perspective. And I had mentioned that even in the doctorate level physical therapy programs, mm-hmm. there's really no training in aquatic therapy. It's something the therapists are mostly expected to specialize in after they graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And if the therapists aren't even trained in this, why would we expect the doctors to know anything about this as well?
But you have to ask, I mean, what brought this up was, our producer, Kay Baker, had the same surgeon as your mother had, right?
Yes.
And she didn't have aquatic because we're looking at her, right? And we're saying, hey, wait a minute. Why didn't you, right? And so the conversation came up was, well, because you had to ask for it.
Yeah.
You know, Kay didn't know, for example, that was an option to ask for that, at least to compare the benefits of one over the other, right?
Yeah, well, and that's one of the reasons why I love the education process so much is because a lot of times aquatic therapy is honestly viewed, even in the therapy world, as a lesser therapy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a last resort. If nothing else is working, we might as well go ahead and try aquatic therapy. And as you just heard, why wouldn't it be one of the first things that we try?
Right.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, number one, but was it a hard sell to get the doctor to agree to it, or did you care?
When the therapist goes in with his mom telling him to operate on her, it's a little easier.
Yeah. There's no question. Absolutely.
Yeah, but obviously there's some confidence level if you go in, right? So you know, making the transition in my mind really becomes one that, hey, it's like everything else we've talked about in this program, Kay, Millie, over the last 2.5 mm-hmm. years. We're responsible for our own health care,
right? That's right, and that's something
and
we've definitely learned.
We have
learned.
To take the... Yes. Take those opportunities to demand and expect.
Yeah,
and I
absolutely.
Have had patients that have told me in the past that their doctors, for whatever reason, were literally resistive to aquatic therapy because they believe that there's no way it can be as good as land. I hear that all the time. And so many times the patients that I know will go to the doctor and tell them, well, if you're not going to let me do aquatics, I will find another surgeon. And the surgeon cannot comprehend that that would be that important mm-hmm. to the patient over his care.
And the other
education's very important.
The other aspect of that we talked about even prior to the show was how many people don't go to therapy because they don't want to go through possibly physical therapy. So the other option that would have been much easier and better to have some therapy than no therapy at all.
Exactly.
So,
but I guess my next question is, if I go to see if my therapist, whatever it is, after knee surgery, for example, and I don't like him, can I just... find an aquatic therapist, or do I have to actually find me a physician that's going to give me a referral to do that?
Yeah, basically.
Or does it depend on the kind of insurance I have?
Well, for the most part, you get an order for therapy. And the way that this really should work is the therapist dictates if aquatic therapy is appropriate. Now, if there's certain precautions, like if there's an infection mm-hmm. or something, that's dictated by the doctor. But in general, the therapist is the one that says it's good or not. I mean, there's always these outlying scenarios, but I had a patient that had been going to another therapy clinic after knee surgery. It was land, and the lady was just crying to the therapist. She was in so much pain. She couldn't. It was a total knee. She couldn't tolerate the therapy, and she was behind schedule. She pleaded with her therapist, can I try aquatic therapy? And mm-hmm. the therapist said no. She said, you don't understand. Your knee is not where it needs to be. You have to get the torque on your knee. The only way that's possible is land. Well, this didn't work out, so the patient quit going there and started seeing me. She was about 6 weeks post-op and way behind. Within 2 weeks, I had her doing better in the water than she had been doing on land. So I'm not saying water is better than land, but it needs to not be assumed to be less.
So would a recommendation be, based on what you're saying, would it be a fair recommendation for any of our listeners or viewers on the Facebook to, if they're having this kind of thing, to look for a therapy organization that has a pool so there's some options when they go in and say, hey, would that be a smart thing to do, at least?
It's always. I mean, what do you think I'm going to say? I'm an aquatic therapist. That's exactly what this is.
Well, but on the other hand, there aren't not every – I've had some therapy.
Yeah.
Very few of them that I've seen have pools, at least in my neck of the woods.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true. And so, I always tell – buyer beware. I always tell the patient to do their research and find out before they're already getting therapy of what their options are.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get a much better picture of what direction you want to go at that point.
I think that's really true. Education.
We know I think we talked about the benefits of getting into the water, so let's move on to something else before the hour gets away from us. We know your passion is in the amazing research of aquatic therapy and how it relates to cognitive function. Can you tell us in some of the studies about how it impacts cognitive function and what the results have been?
Yeah. I would say that I want to take a little bit of a step back and combine what we've known about exercise and cognitive function. What we have recently found with the research with immersion and the brain, things start to make a lot of sense, even when we look at the cognitive decline in patients. There's a strong relationship with the cardiac system and brain function. You know, the weight of the brain is only 2% of the body, and yet it uses 15% of the blood that is pumped from the heart. And so I'd like to give you a list of symptoms when someone has low cardiac volume, and that includes fatigue, decreased exercise tolerance, muscle wasting or weakness, sleep disturbances, early satiety, weight loss, rapid heart rate, urinary abnormality, and impaired cognition. There was a Framingham study. It was released in 2015. They followed 1,000 participants for 11 years. The study found that those with a clinically low cardiac output had 3 times the risk of developing dementia compared to those with a normal cardiac index. They had no other heart conditions, just a low cardiac output. And you have to remember that immersion alone increases cardiac output, and that tends to help with every one of those symptoms. Australia had actually performed studies that showed not only an increase in cerebral blood flow by immersion alone, but when you're exercising in the water at any intensity level, you get even more blood flow to the brain compared to performing the same exercises on land. So it's not a leap of faith to understand why we had the responses from our case studies and the videos that you can find on our website.
Let me ask you a question on that, only in the sense that I can see where you talk about the minimizing of pain that we started this conversation with. Because I know when I go in the water, well, let me go for exercise on land then go to water. I know that when I, because I have bad knees, I know that when I go to the gym and I'm on the treadmill, it hurts the heck out of my knee.
Yeah.
But when I go to a bicycle that less pressure, you know, force, I do okay. I can do 5 miles, no problem. But 1 mile on a treadmill is a real challenge. But I also know when I go into the water, it feels better because I don't have the kind of pressure. So I understand the pain piece, doesn't the exercise and the pumping of blood, isn't that almost just as much if I'm pumping iron big time or in the gym as opposed to how am I pumping more in the water than I am exercise?
Well, a lot of it is just pressure distribution. Remember, the water pressure is pushing the blood in and it's got to go somewhere. So it goes up. So I think I'd mentioned 60% blood volume increases in the thoracic volume, and the muscles have 225% more blood in them at rest. So you're already starting with that advantage. Your blood pressure drops, and what happens is the blood vessels vasodilate. And so what that means is you have less resistance, so the heart can work more efficiently while it's moving more blood. So you just get better results. You mentioned one thing that was a trigger for me. You said 1 mile. So they've done a lot of studies on this. So you have to understand from an energy use perspective. They did studies where they compared walking on land, on a land treadmill, and walking in the water. What they found was when you walk on land 3 miles an hour in a treadmill, you're using the same amount of energy walking 1 mile an hour in the water. And when people start saying about the weight bearing, I get a little touchy about that too, because, you know, we understand buoyancy is very powerful. And so if your chest level in the water, you can remove 75% of your body weight. But I think we have to have the perspective of land. Okay, now I get a little bitter about my land stuff, because what happens when you're standing on land, you weigh 100% of your body weight. But when you're walking, that impact on each step is between 2.5 to 5 times your body weight. When you're running, it's up to 11 times. That's not weight bearing. That's blunt force trauma. So when you're looking at a pain patient, have a little respect about the water, right? Mm-hmm. We can get all this resistance and all this strength without the traumatic impact.
Yeah, you know, and that's a good point. I think one last question before we get on another break. It's going pretty fast.
Yeah,
and I think educating and having our listeners understand what the difference is.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when I asked you the question about the pressure in water, I know at the deep dip there's a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
What I heard you saying was the pressure in just 3 or 4 feet of water is also substantial. We might not feel the pressure, but it's substantial.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Learned something new today.
So I know we are going to a break, but I want you to think about this. I know you produced a video that shows what aquatic therapy can do for cognitive function. So when we come back from the break, I want you to tell us about the video and where our listeners can find it. And really what it was about. Is it the same video?
Well, I thought you were going to show the video.
Yeah. No.
That wouldn't really work really well, okay?
I don't know that Chet has those capabilities in the box.
Stacey's got an XTV, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, well, we've been talking with Stacey Lynch. He's an aquatic therapist on the research of aquatic therapy and end-stage dementia. It's absolutely fascinating. You don't want to miss this next session when we come back, so stay tuned. This is Successful Aging on Independent Talk 1100 KFNX. Welcome back. We are talking with Stacey Lynch. He's an aquatic therapist and founder of Inertia Therapy Services. And before we went to break, we asked him the question. He produced a video that shows what aquatic therapy can do for cognitive function. So I want him to tell our listeners about this because I have actually seen this video and it is amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Most of my research is working with the end-stage, minimally responsive, and sometimes catatonic Alzheimer's population. And the last time I was on your show, I spoke about our first case review that was published in 2013. And, you know, you really have to see the footage. That's why I put it and made it public. Basically, you have a catatonic patient that was non-responsive, and then in the water, he came alive. According to the family and staff, once we got him in the water, his personality resurfaced. He could laugh and joke with the staff. He was able to follow multiple step commands. He even spoke in coherent responses. It was truly amazing. Mm-hmm. And there's a good portion of this entire video footage on the site, as well as a program that I helped start in North Carolina, in Cary, North Carolina. Their staff started getting a group of their moderate to severe Alzheimer's patients into a pool program that had basically the same responses. On my website, I also have a video lecture from Dr. Becker. He's a legend in the realm of aquatic research, and he also co-wrote my last case review. And he goes through a little bit more about the physiological benefits of immersion, if you're interested in that. And then there's other articles and podcasts that I've also done that you can have access to.
And why don't you give where they can find that now? Yeah.
My website, my business website, my education website is inertiatherapy.com. That's mm-hmm. I-N-E-R-T-I-A, therapy.com. And you can also go to Oakeson PT. That's where I work. It's OAKESONPT.com. And on the aquatic tab, there's a little bit about me, and then there's a link to the research page that's on my website as well. And if you have a friend or a family that's interested in physical therapy treatment, I'd recommend you reach out to Oakeson PT. We're an outpatient physical therapy clinic that offers aquatic therapy services, and we're located off of Cactus and 83rd in Peoria.
The first study that you did had some amazing results. Have you done any additional research since then, or any further studies? And if tell us about your latest project.
Yeah, so I mentioned Dr. Becker earlier, and he had been writing about the balancing and the modifying effects of immersion on the autonomic nervous system, and that was used to explain many diagnosis specific responses with aquatic therapy. But you won't find much published research on Alzheimer's disease or cognitive dysfunction prior to that first case study that we did. And this is why we're so motivated to print it. Since that publication, there's been a growing body of research into immersion, aquatic therapy, and cognitive function. And I mentioned the second case review that Dr. Becker helped me write. This was another interesting case with a minimally responsive but non-interactive end-stage dementia patient. The video footage of this one is not online yet, but you can read the case study. As with many of our dementia patients, you can have behavioral episodes, especially with environmental changes. And the patient in this case study, her name was Vicky, and she experienced increases in her physical activity and interaction that was just not feasible on land, increased vocabulary, as well as decreased behavioral episodes. And you can find the link to the study on the website as well. We associate many of her positive responses to the autonomic nervous system due to the changes with immersion. There's also been a lot of recent published studies that have found decreases in behavioral episodes and outbursts as well, as well as overall well-being changes in the dementia patients that have gotten into some kind of an aquatic program.
Let me just ask a quick question on that piece. As you're speaking about this, it's coming to my mind. I'm not sure if I'm getting this correctly. I can see benefits. You know, what we're talking about is a lot of the heart pumping blood mm-hmm. to the brain, et cetera. And of course, the more exercise you do, you're forcing that blood, right?
Exactly.
I got that piece. And I got that, I got the fact that more blood, is pumped in the water because of a couple of factors that you mentioned, which is kind of very interesting. What determinations has the research suggested so far as to how it would help an Alzheimer's person that can't articulate so much? Because that's what is really interesting to me, in the sense that I see the physical piece, okay, because the body is in many regards is an auto reflex, right? The brain's telling the body what to do. And if you can't speak, that doesn't necessarily relate to other type of things. Any suggestion as to how that's happening in Alzheimer's in this case?
It's all pretty much theory at this point. I mean, I would say that there has been a number of studies that have just been overwhelming that doesn't really answer the question, but just makes it even more interesting. There was a study that was done not too long ago, not so much with speech per se, but where they took people, they broke them up into two groups. One group was sitting on a bench on land. The other group was sitting in the water, chest level. Imagine that, in the water. They had headphones. They were listening to a 90-second recorded message. The message had four letters, A, G, M, and O, that was randomly repeating. Mm-hmm. They were given a task. They said, count how many times you hear the letter G, but you can't use your fingers. The people in the water had 42% less mistakes. The only difference was they were immersed in the water. So, you know, take that and interpret it how you will. The idea is we have more stimulation in the water. A lot of my catatonic patients, this is always the question. What do you, and my therapist want to know, what are you doing?
Right. Well, that's the question, right?
The idea is get them in the water. And when they're in the water, they generally become somewhat responsive, and that allows them to do more. And then you do more and they become more responsive, and it just, movement begets movement, activity begets activity, brain function begets brain function. And this is what I think happens.
So the more that then you continue doing that, there may be other aspects of the body that are stimulated by the brain. It may start in one area that you're allowed to get in.
I'm also certified in LSVT Big. It's for Parkinson's treatment. And so there's a lot of understanding that we have now with the vagus nerve. So with these Parkinson's patients, what you'll find is not only are their movements smaller, not only is their posture smaller, but they start to talk really quietly. Mm-hmm. And you tell them to speak up and they can't. But you have to understand, they think they're yelling. That's why they're doing it. So with this Big treatment, the idea is you get them to yell and scream as loud as they can, and they actually start moving better, and they start talking better, and they start thinking better. And so I think this all ties into the same thing. You know, because they're in the water, their movements get bigger. Because they're in the water, it's easier to move and the blood flow.
Yeah, you mentioned that loud theory. At a meeting I was at last week of Midwestern University, they actually have a program called Loud.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It really is amazing.
If you have anybody that has Parkinson's, send them to me. But we don't do the actual Big program at where I work, but I am trained in it. But the idea is that program literally will make you drop your jaw. It is unbelievable responses.
Yeah, it really is.
And I say this as a therapist that did not know about it until a couple of years ago, and I was blown away by it. So.
And who does it come through? Who developed
the loud
it?
People?
The loud people. So I'm not a spokesperson for them, but it was Lee Silverman. Actually, came out of Arizona. Lee Silverman, I think that was the patient.
Oh.
And it was a speech therapist that began. This is where the loud came from.
Okay.
She had, again, my understanding is she basically had a patient that she found that when the patient would do big physical movements, the patient would speak better, and that was great as a speech therapist. Then the physical therapist eventually started saying, "Hey." The opposite is true as well. So it developed from a speech program to a physical therapy program.
Interesting.
And it's a really powerful program.
Wow. So what have been the most noteworthy changes that you've seen in patients that you deal with when it comes to cognitive function? What is the jaw dropping, outcome that had you just going, wow?
You know, I mean, didn't we just go through that? No.
that's true.
Yeah, I know. In my career in working with aquatics, I've generally found positive responses with pretty much every patient. This ranges from physical to emotional as well as cognitive. But there's always these anecdotal stories that just, like you said, I might not have the answer, but they are just intriguing and they make me want to do more research. I had an older gentleman that I was working with for chronic pain. And after a couple of months of aquatic therapy, he came in and he was smiling and he asked me about my work with Alzheimer's. I had referenced it on our first visit, but I didn't know why he was asking me these questions. So this was not a dementia patient. And he explained to me that he used to be a very good chess player, and he was actually a competitive chess player that always won. And he said over the past couple of years, he had stopped playing because he just couldn't win anymore. He said that the only person he would play with now was his wife, and she would always win. Mm-hmm. And he'd learned
nothing wrong with that.
And he'd learned he'd learned to deal with it. He was frustrated with that, but he learned to deal with it. And I asked him to explain to me. I play chess, but I'm not good. Mm-hmm. I said, explain to me what changed. He said that as a competitive chess player, you should always be able to see the moves your opponents make before they make them, and this is where your strategy comes in. But he had lost that ability over the years, and he would lose. Then he started to smile again, and he said he didn't want to jump to any conclusions, but he noticed that after a month of starting aquatic therapy, he started playing and winning with his wife again. And so I asked him, I said, so that's the thing. I said, what changed this time? And he said, that's the thing. I can see her moves before she makes them now. And, you know, it's just overwhelming. I'd like to point out, that there was a study done in 2015, and that was the one with the A, G, M, and O. But then, secondly, at the conference that I hosted in Las Vegas last year, Dr. Sato from Japan, Daisuke Sato, he hasn't published this yet, but he found that if you sit in the chest level water for mm-hmm. 15 minutes, mm-hmm. you have increased brain activity for 2 hours.
Wow.
So,
say that again?
If you sit in a bathtub, this is sitting, this isn't even standing, sitting chest level in the bathtub for 15 minutes, you have increased brain activity for 2 hours.
So if I sat in the bathtub, a jacuzzi bathtub, can I make that longer?
There's other questions, how long you want to sit in the jacuzzi tub. But this is the idea. Now, one of the disagreements that I had with Daisuke was his point was he was kind of overwhelmed because he was hoping to get that evidence. But what he found was in the water, you had less brain activity. So he made an interesting comment. Yeah, that he said it was an interesting comment. He says he recommended, because he was a neuroscientist, he said, I recommend you therapists do your physical activity in the water and brain activity after. I completely disagreed, because when you look at the lungs, the heart, the kidneys, every single system in the body is more efficient in the water. Mm-hmm. So my point was, if there's less brain activity in the water, that would mean it's more efficient, not less efficient. Mm. He didn't really grasp that. And I said, look at that AGM&O study. If you have 42% less mistakes, and the brain is working less, something's got to be going on.
Right.
So,
well, you're listening to Successful Aging on Independent Talk 1100 KFNX. And when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Stacy Lynch, aquatic therapist on the research of aquatic therapy and Alzheimer's disease. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. We're talking with Stacy Lynch, the founder of Inertia of Therapy Services. Stacy, I tell you, this has been just a great 45 minutes this morning, and we're our progress is very slow but very good. Let's talk about change gears for just a second. You work a little bit with other organizations such as this, so talk about any collaboration you might do with something like the Alzheimer's Association, and if you do those kinds of things, talk to us about that process and what they think about what you're doing with your research in these areas.
Thanks. As you noticed, I always have a setup for my answers. It's mm-hmm. never that simple. So,
you must be related to me.
We're always trying to get the word out, on some new concepts, and whenever you're trying to get the word out on a new concepts with any medical based associations, I've learned that it can take time to make these contacts. And I believe this is because there's such a focus in America on pharmaceutical intervention that with all the promising new drugs that just really don't deliver, patients and caregivers almost become numb to the new intervention ideas and concepts. And if we go back to potential drugs for Alzheimer's treatment, you may have heard that in early 2018 in January, Pfizer, the third largest pharmaceutical company, announced that it would end all research and development efforts into new drugs and treatments for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And then other pharmaceutical companies also followed suit. And to clarify that was not my interpretation of what Pfizer did, Mikhail Dolsten was their president of worldwide research and development for Pfizer. And he stated, we recognized our ongoing efforts were not going to deliver the impactful medical advances for patients that we had aspired to achieve. Mm-hmm. So what generally happens is word spreads and about our work and then the results and how we get the responses with our patients. But people always say they want to have me speak, they want to have me help, but until they actually see the video footage and mm-hmm. actually hear me present with a lot of this data specifically, like on this show, things don't really happen. We're currently in an upswing for this year. I recently met with a local Alzheimer's Association support group, and we had great response, and I'll probably meet with them again soon to help them set up a program for them. Just this month, I met with some of the medical staff at Barrow's Neurological Institute, and I'm now talking with their lead contact about some work and possible research with their dementia population. Her name is Debbie Harbinson, And I have a couple of education lectures scheduled at Glencroft University later this year. And I'm in talks, believe it or not, with the Greater Phoenix Mensa regional meeting
smart
that I
people.
Might do. Yeah, they. So apparently they heard my research. They might not have heard me, though. And if any of your listeners have a support group or a venue where you'd like me to give a presentation, please feel free to reach out to me. I love doing this.
You want to give us your contact information again, or other than what we have, as long as we're on that subject?
Yeah, my website for Inertia is Inertia Therapy. So it's inertiatherapy.com. And then where I work is Okeson PT, that's OakesonPT.com. And again, we're off of Cactus and 83rd in Peoria.
Let me get back to that, well, to that last point just a second. I want to ask this follow-up question. You talked about the idea of new, and that always seems to be a problem. Many conversations that we have on our program is that new seems to kind of cloud the thing, but people want to try it. If a lot of people want to know what's the downside. You know, new can be the new question in my 2.5 years we've been doing this program, right. Millie, has been if you get past the downside part of the question, it opens up the whole world, a new world for people to try something new and I personal experience. So what would the, if I ask you the question, or right now I'm asking you, what's the downside of doing aquatherapy, if there is one?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you look at the basic side effects would be with prolonged exposure. So if you have chlorine sensitivity or something like that, that might be an issue. If there's some kind of an allergic reaction, if there's a phobia of water, obviously that would be a concern. The big things are water is a big diuretic. So when you're in the water, because of the autonomic nervous system, when you get out of the water, there's a reason you pee a lot. Your brain is telling your body to purge excess fluid. And in doing that, you dump about 10 times the amount of sodium, which could be a good thing, unless you have low sodium levels. And you also dump about 6 times the amount of potassium. So if you have cramping at night, that's where the cramping tends to come from. But you can generally offset those. But I always say, you know, when you're dealing, as a therapist, when you're dealing with this whole issue of contraindications, you know, that sets me off too, because my big statement is contraindications are relative to the therapist and doctor performing the procedure. So for me, if I work with a patient with a trach, if I work with a patient that has phobia, literal fear of the water, I'm good at that. That's what I do. I wouldn't recommend anybody else do that.
Let me rephrase the question, because we're getting real close to the end here. My question isn't about things of that nature. My question is, when people, because if they have pain or they have a surgery issue, would the negative be potential impact on the pain or the issue that they have? Would it make your knee go worse, for example, if you had surgery? Mm-hmm. If that's not a downside, that's a pretty good reason for getting in it, right?
That's, as a therapist specifically, it shouldn't. I mean, that's my job is to get patients better. And so if I'm working, so I always say to, you know, they always say, you know, get a doctor's order, make sure you check with your doctor before you do any changes. So as a therapist, I always look at a patient and can always assess if something is incorrect, if something mm-hmm. is wrong. And then we can also refer for other, diagnostic consults if needed. But that's kind of the job of the therapist and the doctor. They should be able to assess that.
So, Stacy, when someone gets done with aquatic therapy, meaning a session, do you have exercises or things that they can do at home that will help to complement the aquatic therapy that they're receiving?
Yeah, it's always patient specific. Some people have a pool in their backyard. Some mm-hmm. people have a gym membership. Some people don't. And,
right.
and so I kind of cater what they're doing with that. Even mm-hmm. if they don't have access to a pool, you can still get a lot of these surges and benefits from sessions. What I like about aquatic therapy is on land, we give home exercise programs that have to be very specific. They put, mm-hmm. they point their thumb in the wrong position. They can cause problems.
Right.
In the water, you have a much bigger buffer. And if they simply get in the water, they get these benefits. And I can give them a lot of concepts to do in the water within the first visit.
Right.
You know, on the first visit on land, if they say, I got a gym at the apartment, can I use it? You can't tell them, yeah, I go play around with the weights.
Can,
yeah.
can they, yeah. could they actually do, this is kind of half serious, half in jest. Could they do, if they don't have a pool at home, could they do some kind of therapy while they're sitting in their tub at the chest level?
We're still dealing with water. That's why when I give that first beginning part, that's with immersion only.
Right.
So if you just sit there and do nothing, you get the benefits. God forbid they move.
Right.
I mean, this is
God forbid.
The whole point. I mean, if they move, you're just going to enhance everything. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So then you look at the temperature of the water, that can make changes and everything else.
How about digestive issues? I heard that physical therapy can help with digestive issues and other things like that. Is this true?
Well, aquatic therapy, and again, we look at the scope of practice, so we don't really deal specifically with that, but you look at the research. Japan did a great study in 2012. They looked at peristaltic movement of the esophagus.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, what you want, I'm not a speech therapist, but I've consulted with some, and what you want with that swallow reflex, you want that high amplitude over a long period of time, and that's enhanced in the water.
Yeah.
So they theorized that it would help with digestion and GERD and things like that.
All right. I got the nod.
I know. You got the sign. Oh,
What does that mean? We've been talking today with Stacy Lynch, the aquatic physical therapist, on the research of aquatic therapy and Alzheimer's disease. Thank you, Stacy. It's been great having you on the show today. And not only was it really interesting, unfortunately, it opened up a whole new avenue of things to talk about.
And we'll all be taking baths in the evening
into
now.
The bath tonight. I also like to thank our technical engineer, Chet Reynolds. Great job, Chet. Our producer, Kay Baker. And, of course, my co-host, Millie Okeson. This is Successful Aging. I'm John Wenslow, an Independent Talk 1100 KFNX. If you have any questions on today's show or on Successful Aging, please call us at 888-882-7784 or check us out online at successfulaging.info. Join us next week at the same time. Have a great day, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.